UK Wine Show, show number 137. Jancis Robinson on Wine Education. Happy New Year. If you were motivated by New Year's Eve to get educational in 2009, then this week we have the interview for you. This week we're talking with Jancis Robinson about wine education.
And in the news, Christmas sales a mixed picture, drinks duty at 10-year low, and Chateau Latour may be up for sale.
Happy New Year and welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 137 for the 2nd of January 2009. My name's Chris Scott, and some of you may have noticed that we took a week off over Christmas. So I hope your Christmas went well. Mine went very well. Now, enough looking back. On this week's show, we're talking with Jancis Robinson on wine education. In the spotlight, we look at the results of our poll. What kind of sparkling wine did you mostly drink over Christmas? And this week's quote, good wine ruins the purse, bad wine ruins the stomach. Clues throughout the show, answer at the end. But next up, we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Retailers are reporting a mixed picture for pre-Christmas wine sales, with general trading down in spend while volume sales held up. Fine wine merchants Berry Brothers and Rudd estimated that business was down 25 to 30% in value. That was despite the merchant's most successful web promotion ever, which attracted 550 orders within its first hour. Despite the rise in orders, though, average spend was down by more than 50%. Another fine wine merchant, John Armit, held its winter sale early and said business was definitely slower than last year, but was nonetheless holding up fairly well. And Great Western Wine, based in Bath, said the picture was mixed, with trade at about the same level as 2007 and web sales contributing more than they did last year. But their fine wine sales were not so buoyant, and the corporate gift business, they said, had been very disappointing. Meanwhile, Waitrose said customers were sticking with well-known, reliable brands and playing safe with Champagne, Chablis, Rioja and New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. They said year-to-date champagne sales were up 10.5% and the average spend per bottle had risen from £5.85 before March to around £6 in the autumn.
Cheers. In October 2008, when Lehman Brothers went down and the banks were starting to fall like dominoes, I got very nervous in our business. But our sales figures have been excellent for 2008. While the newspapers go on about this recession, not all businesses are going to go under. Sure, businesses that were struggling during their boom years may go down, but in their death gives opportunity to competitors, making them stronger. While 2009 is not going to be an easy year if you're in business, the doom, I think, is a bit over the top. One company that is selling assets are the owners of Latour, the Bordeaux First Growth. What's going on there, Jane?
Well, according to the Sunday Times, Bordeaux first growth property Chateau Latour is up for sale. The Latour estate in Poillac has been owned by French business tycoon François Pinault, whose stable of businesses includes Christie's Auction House and fashion brands Gucci and Puma. Pinault acquired the winery in 1993 for £86 million under his holding company Artemis. The Sunday Times reported a potential price tag of between £145 million and £193 million, or €150 million to €200 million. Those sources in Bordeaux suggest the property would not go for less than €600 million. The estate comprises 78 hectares, but only grapes from 47 hectares surrounding the chateau, known as L'Enclos, are used in the first wine. The other wines are used for the second label, Le Fort de la Tour.
So, what's a shadow like that worth these days? Well, as Jane said, there's 47 hectares in use, and for a first growth, they're probably producing about, give or take, around 30,000 hectolitres per hectare, which means they're producing about 1,400 hectolitres a year, or 188,000 bottles of wine. Now, Latour's 2007 wine is currently worth around £220 a bottle, which values their 2007 vintage at £41 million, and given the pound's got parity with euro at the moment, €41 million. Now, they wouldn't normally sell the wine for the same price that it's on market, usually it's a bit less, but £600 million seems an awfully high price, and £150 million, that seems a bit low. What's next?
Finally this week, despite drinks industry claims that alcohol duty is being used as a cash cow by the Treasury, revenue from duty is at its lowest level for a decade. Official government figures show that in 2007 to 2008, revenue and customs collected just under £7.9 billion worth of duty from drinks. That compares to the decade's highest figure of £9.1 billion in 2004 to 2005. That was according to Angela Eagle, Exchequer Secretary to the Treasury, who was responding to a question posed by Conservative MP Jeremy Hunt. Alcohol duty contributed 1.8% of HMRC revenues in 2007-08, which has gradually fallen from 2.2% in 2003-04. That's it from me this week, but don't forget you can get these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. Given the stellar rise of duty over the last couple of years, up 18% this year alone, you need to ask yourself, are people drinking less, or is it just that they're buying their alcoholic drinks in France and shipping them home? When I joined the trade 6 years ago, loads of people used to go to France to buy drinks and bring them back. Of course, there is the other argument that people are drinking less. I do hope this is true, but I suspect it's probably a mixture of both. That ends the news. Next up, we're going to be looking at the spotlight, which was from our poll question, you may recall. What kind of sparkling wine will you mostly be drinking to celebrate Christmas? Well, let's have a look at the results. 62% of people said they drank champagne this Christmas, or at least were planning on doing so when they were asked just before Christmas. Cava is holding up at number 2 on 11%, and it goes to show its strong appeal. Prosecco is 7%, and it's not surprising this northern Italian sparkler has been growing in strength in the UK over the last couple of years. 6% of people said they would not be drinking fizz at all, which would probably indicate that they don't like sparkling wines. Remember, everybody who enters our polls have either done it at a wine tasting or through our wine website, so it's highly unlikely they're not into wine. I was a bit surprised with Australia, with only 3% saying they're going to drink Australian sparkling wine. The final area was other sparkling wines, and this came in with quite a strong showing of 11%, which shows that there's quite a good range of different styles of sparkling wines out there that the English people is willing to give it a go. As I said for the poll on the current economic conditions we had a couple of months ago, the value of this type of poll question will be next year when we compare results, so stay tuned for that. That pretty much ends the look at the spotlight this week. Next week we're going to be looking at the book by Oz Clark, Bordeaux, and reviewing that. I'm sure Oz would agree with me when saying that good wine ruins a purse, bad wine ruins the stomach. To be honest, in the quote this week, I can't give you too many clues without giving it away. But I do like the saying, as it encourages people being frugal, but not silly about penny pinching. Sensible sentiment, if you ask me. Sensible as the quote may be, it's something that my New Year's Eves have got more sensible as time goes on. But with only one resolution, something about losing a couple of kgs. I didn't have any other pledges. But if yours was learning more about wine, then the interview next with Jancis Robinson may help you decide about what educational binge you're going to go on. Next up, we're going to be talking with Jancis about wine education and her own wine educational development. Hi, I'm here with Jancis Robinson, wine writer and MW. How are you, Jancis?
I'm fine, thanks.
Just out of interest, you're married, but Robinson was your maiden name, isn't it? Why did you continue with that afterwards?
I'd already written one book under the name Jancis Robinson, so I thought it would be a bit confusing to change. And
fiercely independent woman? Or
yeah, I mean, come on. It's interesting how these things go in generations, though. My daughters wouldn't dream of using Ms, you know, whereas it's definitely a title for my generation.
Yeah. What we're going to be talking about today is wine education, because you've gone through the whole gambit, all the way through from starting at the very bottom, all the way to the very
top. I had my first job writing about wine the 1st of December 1975, when I couldn't even type, let alone answer a question about wine. It was a wine trade magazine, and they said they took me on because I'd shown that I could run the skiing side of Thompson Holidays, Britain's biggest travel company, and they reckoned they needed a good organiser, and I was probably a good organiser, and I'd organise myself to learn about what I didn't know. It's certainly true. I did sign up for the Wine and Spirit Education Trust classes straight away, and I joked with my friends that there would probably be a question that was Valpolicella is A red, B white, C rosé, and there was actually a question, Valpolicella is A French, B Spanish, C Italian. But I worked my way up and did the diploma, got the top prize in the diploma in 1978, but at that stage you couldn't go on and do the Master of Wine unless you were actually in the trade. And then come 1984, when the MWs realised that they weren't immortal and that...
They were dying off.
And they were going to have to recruit some new blood. They decided to change the rules. And the first thing they did was allow Brits who weren't in the trade to take it.
But you were in the trade because you were working for a trade publication. Was it more merchants?
They meant buying and selling it, which I've never done.
Yeah.
And so, but they came to me and said, oh, come on, have a go, because you did well in the diploma and we need more people. And in a way, it was crazy.
Was there many women who'd done the MW by that stage?
I think there were about six, something like that. All my friends said, you're crazy to do this, because by that stage, I was the Sunday Times wine correspondent. I'd done one very high-profile television series on Channel 4, a very early one on wine, called The Wine Programme, which I think was the world's first series about wine, actually, television series about wine. And I had several books to my name, and my husband and my friend said, look, you stand to lose far more by failing than you stand to gain by passing.
Yeah.
But I went to a grammar school, and I've got one of those awful kind of Northern English mentalities where, you know, give me a challenge and I'll try to do it. And for good measure, we were filming the second series of the wine programme, and I said, well, why don't we make following me doing the Master of Wine exam an ingredient in the show? So it would be really public humiliation to fail.
Can they just cut that out?
Yeah, I think in the back of my mind, we can always leave that on the cutting room floor. And, small matter, I was pregnant. Yes, expecting our second child in September 84. So I did the exams in May 84. And I think it helped me being pregnant because I think it does heighten your tasting, your senses. And I know that I did particularly well in the tasting because I was asked the next year to go and give the talk on tasting. And so at that time, I remember distinctly getting the envelope, the big fat envelope that signifies that you've actually passed, while we were on holiday in Cornwall, and being thrilled, how thrilling that was. But I thought at the time, because I was by far and away the first wine writer to take the Master of Wine exams, I just thought, oh, well, obviously wine writers know enough to pass. That's fine.
Yep.
And I have to say, it was only when various other wine writers had a go didn't pass. No names. Absolutely not. No names. That I suddenly realised, hey, that was quite an achievement.
Yeah,
I started to feel proud of myself.
Yeah, no. I've spoken to Tim Atkins.
Good for him. He was another one, actually, who... He did the Master of Wine even later in his wine writing career than I did.
Mm.
And I take my hat off to him for doing it, because it's a heck of a lot of work, and even more now than it was in my day.
Do you think it's got harder over time?
I don't think it's relatively got harder in that they're trying to exclude people, but just because the world of wine has got so much more complex, necessarily the exam to keep up standards has got more complex.
I was talking to someone who'd sat the MW unsuccessfully last week.
Well, most people do, after all. I mean, you know, a lot of people, it takes many, many years to get through, and I would just happen to have a good wind behind me
to pass the first time. Yeah, 2 years, isn't it, to do the course?
Well, it was a little bit less structured then. I just got my head down. And
looking back through your WST, your diploma, and then your MW, where do you think you probably learnt the most? Was it at the MW, or was it at the start when everything's new and opening up in front of you?
I'll tell you when I thought I knew the most, which isn't exactly an answer to your question, but when I'd finished the WSET diploma course, I seriously thought I knew everything. I thought, right, that's it. I know about wine now. And, of course, what a fool I was. And now I'm still learning so much. I learn lots every single day. And you don't, if you're any good, you don't stop. You stop learning. You have to realise that you've just started and that wine's moving on even faster than your knowledge is.
Yeah.
When did I learn? I just have found my professional life is a constant series of learning, really.
And what degree do you think, or which part of the thing, like WCT diploma, all that sort of stuff, do you think is most useful for someone who, just go through the different roles in the wine trade, you know, something like someone working in a majestic shop selling wine, you know, is the diploma too much or is it more the intermediate?
Well, the trouble is they keep changing the courses, you know. Oh, I mean, it's so long ago since I, you know, when I did my WSET courses in the late 70s, so I'm way out of touch with what they're like now, I'm afraid.
Do you not deal with people who way back in those low WSET people?
Well, I'm
very much grandiose here.
No. I mean, I know lots of people who do them, and lots of good. I've made a lot of good friends of people I've come across because they sort of make a beeline for WSET courses, and some people, you know, even crossing the Atlantic to renting apartments here to stay in while they're doing their WSET exams. But you'd be amazed to hear, we don't sit around and discuss the detail of their courses, really. So that's why I think I'm out of date. I suppose I'd just recommend people to keep on learning as long as they're interested, really.
You obviously came through WCT and the NMW system. There must be other reputable educational wine education.
Yes.
Can you give us a couple of names of one, or even in different countries?
Well, I mean, I take my hat off to anyone who does a proper university degree in oenology and or viticulture, because they will have far more in-depth information about winemaking and vine growing than a Master of Wine does. I mean, the distinction of the Master of Wine exam is that it's breadth, really, more than its depth, that you have to know a reasonable amount about an awful lot. Whereas if you were to do one of those graduate programs, you know, you'd be going far more into the chemistry, say.
Yeah.
But you probably wouldn't know much about wine made in countries outside the country where you did your study.
Sure.
So I suppose it's horses for courses. If you're inheriting a domain in Burgundy, then it's a very good idea to go to Dijon and study oenology and viticulture there.
Yeah, sure. What about over in the States, or even if you're not a winemaker or a viticulturist, because WCT's over there, but there must be other companies doing equivalent stuff.
Well, I must say, I take my hat off to WSET under its current hyper-energetic director,
Ian
Harris, who really has made WSET a global force in not that many years.
No.
And there isn't a comparable organisation to WSET in America. We have actually managed to overtake the Americans in that field. There is the Association of American Wine Educators, or whatever they're called, and yes, there are some really good programs in New York and in California, in some of the big cities, but there isn't one overarching syllabus that they're all following the way that WSET is now exported and exportable.
Yeah. Your recommendation is that if you're going through the wine trade and you're trying to get some education?
I don't think WSET is bad at all.
No.
And they are constantly updating it. I mean, you'd probably say not every single WSET lecturer is absolutely brilliant.
Oh, but, no, I'd be comfortable you saying that.
But that would be an impossibility, given that there are hundreds of them now. But, you know, they're there. They're active in Korea and Slovenia and all over the world, as far as I can see.
And what sort of other things, apart from obviously education, do you think would help someone stay relevant or up to date or get new information from your perspective on wine?
Well, I've just written an article on this subject, actually. Because lots of people say to me, how do I learn more about wine? Because there's a huge thirst for knowledge there, and people just don't know how to start. And a lot of people don't want to go and shut themselves up in a classroom on the same night every week.
Or spend Saturday and Sunday like I did, going through regions.
Yeah. Yes, and I suppose what an outsider might expect me to say is read my book, subscribe to my website, watch my videos. But actually, I don't, and I don't even in print. What I always say is that there are very strong parallels between wine and books, and there's a lot of subjectivism in what you like and what you don't like, but great similarities in how you can learn more and get better recommendations. And my suggestion to anyone who wants to learn about wine is to identify a friendly local wine retailer and go to them, as you would a nice local bookshop, and go to them, tell them what you like so far, and ask them to recommend something more interesting or perhaps better value or that'll stretch you a little bit. And, you know, you might have to try a few until you find someone that you actually like and you get on with and you trust, and you find that their recommendations are worthwhile. But that, I think the human recommendation, absolutely based on you personally, is invaluable.
That's quite nice, because then you can discuss it with them and why you like wine. And if you don't like wine, why you don't like wine.
Yeah, and I think the retailer will respond to that. I mean,
they,
you know,
that's what they love.
They love it. And and they do spend an awful lot of time behind the counter, you know, selling packs of cigarettes and something that's not very interesting.
Sure.
So I think that's a virtuous circle, really.
No, that's a fair comment. Any particular... No, I won't ask for any particular retailer. We'll pass on that.
Well, I'm just so pro all the independents. So I think it's great that in Britain at the moment we're having a mushrooming of...
Is there really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the factors has been the demise of Oddbins, which used to attract all those wine nuts who were happy to while away a day in a wine store. Mm. Oddbins lost its gloss, and it'll be very interesting to see what happens under the new ownership.
Yeah.
And thereby lost Hemeridge quite a lot of good people, and quite a lot of those good people have set up on their own. I mean, whether their businesses are in the long term sustainable, I don't know, because there's a tendency not to have a great business plan, just to say, I love wine, to be operating on margins that are perhaps unreasonably small.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are doing it online, so they don't have to pay rents and things like that.
I've noticed that actually online. Went to the International Wine Competitions Awards a couple of weeks ago, and I spoke to a couple of online wine retailers who had just started up really online, and that was quite interesting to see what they're doing. But you won't necessarily get the feedback by talking to someone online, would you?
No, but then you can probably do get on telephone or email.
True.
But it is preferable to be able to wander into a little store, certainly.
Yeah, it's fun browsing.
Yeah, it's lovely. It is so different, isn't it, looking at shelves rather than looking at a list on a website.
It's more fun.
Yeah.
It's a lot better. Okay then, Jensis, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
Great.
Cheers. Hope you enjoyed that interview with Jensis. It's nice to start the new year looking at education in the future. Next week, we're going to be looking at organic wine. And in particular, we're going to be looking at a really crazy fella called Will Davenport. He's an organic producer in England, a very wet wine-growing region, and a higher climate to grow organic wines. But before we close up, how are you getting on with the quote? Good wine ruins the purse, bad wine ruins the stomach. Well, this saying is from a non-English-speaking European wine-producing country, and it is... Spain. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.